Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today my guest is author and former professional football player, Tony Mandarich. He is here today to talk to us about his new tell-all book, My Dirty Little Secrets, Steroids, Alcohol, and God, which was just released on Modern History Press and co-authored with Sharon Shaw Elrod. So Tony Mandarich was born in Oakville, Ontario, Canada, the son of Croatian immigrants who instilled in him grit and determination to accomplish the impossible. Tony grew up with a love for football and decided early in his life that he would play professionally. After a highly successful and nationally publicized collegiate career at Michigan State University, Tony was drafted number 2 overall in 1989 by the Green Bay Packers. The hype about being the best offensive line prospect ever, along with Tony's addictions, was more than he could live up to, and his life came crashing down around him. After 3 more years of alcohol and painkiller abuse, Tony accepted the hand of God, went into treatment, and now considers it a privilege to be able to help other addicts and alcoholics when called upon. Tony and his wife, Charlevan, have 4 children. They own and operate Mandarich Media Group in Scottsdale, Arizona. It's a full-service web media business specializing in website development and optimization, video production, photography, and internet marketing. And Tony's website, where you can find out more about him, his book, his business, is tonymandarich.com. So that said, welcome to the program, Tony.
Well, Juanita, thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you so much. Well, I understand that you really have actually wanted to tell this story for a long time, so it must just be amazing to have your book finally in print.
Yes, I've wanted to do this now for 10 years since I retired from Indianapolis in 1999. I kept running into kind of what I would call speed bumps with big publishers, and they were kind of the angle that unless I were to name names and kind of throw people under the bus, that they weren't interested because they just came out and said controversy will sell. And, I felt that there was enough controversy in my own story, and I didn't want to, bring other people into it. I didn't think that would be fair, so I didn't. So it delayed it, almost 10 years, and we were lucky enough to get an opportunity with Modern History Press, and here we are published and out on the market.
Yes, congratulations. So why was it so important for you to tell your story?
The two main reasons for me writing the book were, number one, to help. A lot of the book is about recovery. It is about sports, too, and it's about my career. You couldn't write the book without talking about that. But the rest of it is about recovery and the addictions that I faced with alcohol and drug abuse and the things I did to face those adversities. So I think that anybody, and you don't necessarily have to be or have to have even been a professional athlete to relate to this, anybody that has had any kind of a problem or that is in the middle of a problem with addiction will be able to relate to this. And so that will help them. And then, the number two motive for writing this book was, a lot of people think or were under the impression that the big failure I had in Green Bay was strictly 100% due to steroids, and that was really a small part of it. Most of it was, the behind-the-scenes drug addiction to painkillers and pretty much, drinking on a daily basis, and everybody was so focused on steroids that they missed the obvious.
So this was really your attempt to really clear the record and really tell the truth about what happened.
Yeah, it was definitely to set the record straight and kind of give people an explanation. Still, regardless of what the explanation is, the problem was me, and the common denominator in all the problems was me. So the problems were of my own doing, and I felt that people really should know the truth. Whether they like me or not, they should know the truth about what happened, and because there was a lot of things that the media and the general public had no idea about.
Mm-hmm. I really would like to get into the whole story of addiction and in your recovery process, but let's just go first into your early childhood love for the sport of football and how you prepared yourself for the NFL and then the draft that came in 89.
You know, at a pretty early age, 11 or 12 years old, I had been playing football on the playground with my neighborhood buddies for years, and I absolutely loved playing football. I loved watching football on TV, playing it, and at 11 years old, I had enough conviction to say to myself that I wanted to make it to the NFL and I wanted to play professional football. And I had kind of set goals for myself, and I said, whatever I do from here forward, I want to make proactive decisions to make that goal as attainable as possible. And obviously that included things like, you know, getting good grades, staying in school, getting an education, working out, running, all those things that go with athletics. And I felt that I did that. And once I got to high school, I excelled a little bit, obviously concentrated more on weightlifting because, I was a little bit older. And the goal at that point was to get a scholarship to a major university. And then that goal was achieved when Michigan State offered me a scholarship. So now the next level is to, go through college, get an education, give yourself the best possible opportunity to make it into the NFL and get drafted. Those two were the sole focuses for 5 years in college. And I would say at least half the time, the focus was extreme when it came to making it to the NFL. I was in the weight rooms, sometimes 7 days a week for months, and it was too much, but it was just that extreme, personality that I have.
Don't you have to be that extreme, though, if you're going to go into a professional sport like the NFL?
Yeah, I really do think that you can't be a 9-to-5 person. I think that you have to be there before and after 9-to-5 and during 9-to-5.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's a different kind of ethic or work habit, whatever you want to call it. Not that it's right or wrong, it's just it is what it is. There's a lot of hours to put in and a lot of work to put in. Then, after the 5 years of college, I got drafted as the second pick in the 1989 draft, and everything seemed to be going on schedule, and the goals, take yourself back to 11 years old and then take yourself to draft day, and you're kind of like,
wow.
This is it. I mean, what we've worked for, what I've dreamed, what I've imagined has come to fruition.
It's incredible that you really, at such a young age, were so determined and it really carried that through your adolescence, where many people would be pulled in so many other directions. You really held your ground.
Yeah, I would say that because obviously I've been with myself my whole life and I know what I'm like, I've always felt that everybody is like this. And a perfect example is my kids. They're not like this.
Oh, yeah.
And in a lot of instances, that's a good thing, because extreme is not always good. Extreme is very good if you can harness it and if you can use it as a virtue instead of a vice. But if you're not careful, it can turn into a vice and take you down roads that, will end up hurting you more than helping you. But, when I even talk to my 17, almost 18-year-old daughter, she's still not sure what she wants to study in college. And I'm like, how can you not be sure? At 11, I knew what I wanted to do. So, but hanging around other friends, kids, they have the same reaction that my daughter has. They're just not sure yet. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
My situation was different.
Mm-hmm.
Again, not that it was right or wrong. It's just it is what it is. And I knew what I wanted at a very young age and kind of grabbed the bull by the horns and pursued it.
Now, do you think that your upbringing, your parents and their history, was that any kind of influence on that extreme nature, that determination that you had?
Yeah, I think it was a big influence, because when I was, very young, we lived on a farm and it was always work, work, work. I remember I would hate that the weekend would be here, because that mean, it was time to play with your friends and have fun. What it meant was that we had to work on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but I'm glad that that happened, because I think it instilled a work ethic in me. And being around your parents all the time, you get to see, you know, how much they work, how much effort they do, and as you grow up into an adult and you can reflect back, you can really see how much they, you know, dedicated themselves to work and commitment to their family.
Mm. Now, when you went through into the recovery process, obviously a part of that is to look at your childhood and you know, consider that maybe there was places that set the stage for any kind of addictive patterns. Did you notice any of that?
I didn't notice any of that in my parents. You know, my dad's in his mid to upper 70s. My mom's like 74. And I've never in my life seen either one of them drunk.
Mm.
And now they both drink socially, but I've never seen them get to the point where I obviously got to, where it almost killed me. Mm. So that was like apparently one of those things, although they have extreme, you know, tendencies and personalities for commitment to certain things, whether it's family or work or whatever the case may be, they obviously harnessed it a lot better than I did.
Mm-hmm.
And in their, you know, late teens, early 20s, they escaped from, you know, communism in the former Yugoslavia to come to the West to have a better life for their family. So that is pretty extreme to do something like that. And when I think about, you know, how hard it is to play football or whatever, you know, that pales in comparison to some of the stuff that they had to go through.
Yeah, incredible story, I'm sure. So when did alcohol and drugs actually come into the picture for you?
In an abusive kind of way, I would say, you know, it started probably towards, you know, it was toward the transition from college to professional football. The steroids I did use the whole 5 years that I was there. And I guess I would definitely consider that drug abuse, doing it because you have to, for 18, 20 years old, you really don't need steroids. If you're brittle and sick and you need steroids for strength, for just to walk, that's a different story. But we were young, healthy. You know, I was young and healthy and strong, and I still took them because I wanted the advantage, because I wanted the edge. And so that went on for 5 years of college, and then the transition from college to professional football is when the painkillers and the alcohol, more of the alcohol, like alcoholic drinking, what I call behaviors, started happening. You know, although I drank in college, and yes, there was times that, you know, that we went out and got really drunk and you know, were out with friends at bars and whatever, you know, the next day, you know, I didn't feel the compulsion that I had to keep drinking, or the day after that I was like, well, you know, next time we feel like going out, we'll go out. It wasn't a priority. Well, in that transition phase, it became a priority, and it almost became a necessity. And that's a pretty blunt switch. And when you look back, you know, one morning you wake up and you say to yourself, well, how in the world did I get to this point?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not careful, it really, you know, sneaks up on you.
Yes. It's such an interesting contradiction, though, when you're in a field where you have to be in top physical form, and here you are basically in full addiction, drinking every day, using painkillers every day, steroids every day. I mean, it's very interesting that your body didn't break down, or that you were really able to continue functioning.
Yeah, it's a great statement. And in reality, it did break down, because mm-hmm. my performance level went from extremely high to extremely low. I was less than half the player that I was when I was not intoxicated or not totally on pain, you know, painkillers and trying to numb myself. And that was evident on the field. I could tell watching film of the game the day after, and obviously my performance suffered. But the interesting thing is, you know, everybody on the outside was like, well, he's off of steroids, because in that transition, I got off of steroids. Uh-huh. And that's when everybody kind of started to point the finger and saying, well, it's probably because he took steroids in college and now he doesn't take them anymore, and he's, you know, not the same player. Where, in fact, what was going on was I was taking anywhere from 20 to 60 painkillers a day, and you know, drinking, and trying to also keep a job and play professional football and do all those things. And it's hard enough to play professional football sober, let alone, you know, half in the bag.
Right, right. And especially with painkillers that basically just make you so drowsy. And
that's incredible.
Well, with the steroid use, how did you actually start taking steroids?
I had a month left in high school. It was my senior year of high school, so it was May of 1984, and I was working out, and I had come to a plateau where I could not bench press 315 pounds, and the plateau was 315 pounds was three big plates on each side of the bar, and I think it was a psychological effect, too, that why I couldn't do it. So my brother, who's 5 years older than me, had said that he was taking steroids, and he said, you know, this is an option if you want to do it. He said, by no means do you have to, but I just want you to know that the option's there, and I was, you know, all for it.
You didn't question it at all?
I didn't question it at all, you know, and especially since it was, you know, my brother, because it was somebody I trusted. But, you know, I was old enough. I was 17 years old where, I mean, I knew the difference between right and wrong. And I knew that you know, in society that this is kind of a no-no, especially in sports, but I wanted to try it and to see what would happen. And, you know, 6 weeks later, I did bench over 315 pounds, and I did get stronger. So the steroids did work, but, you know, in a lot of ways, as I look back and reflect, they were definitely a gateway drug for me to get into deeper and darker things. And in no way have I ever or would I ever point the finger at my brother for any of the things that happened because, you know, I was old enough.
You were
to know
a grown man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he never said, you have to do this. He you know, was honest with me.
Mm-hmm. So they didn't test you back then for steroids?
Well, I was just leaving high school, so that was really a non-issue. When I was in college, they only tested you for steroids if you made it to a bowl game. And that first year, we did go to a bowl game, but it was a smaller bowl game, so they did not test.
Mm.
And then the second year, I had just gotten off the steroids, you know, say 3 months before I knew we had a bowl game, so I didn't test positive. And it was it's easier to pass a drug test if they tell you when it's coming.
Yeah, right. Okay.
You know, I mean, it kind of defeats the purpose of
right.
the whole system. That it should be random, and it should be, you know, anytime, 12 months a year, you know, any time of the week and stuff like that. So
yeah, that's kind of questionable that they tell you ahead of time.
Yeah, You know, that was a direct result of why I could pass those tests. And, you know, and I did end up cheating on a few of those tests because I didn't feel that I was gonna be clean. And so I cheated on some of those tests by swapping out, you know, clean urine and, you know, passing those tests.
So you did all of that. So was there any withdrawals when you would get off of steroids? Is it that addictive?
Well, I would say the steroids were very minimal physical withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't go through a detox or where you were hurting or nothing like that. Although, on the other hand, the psychological withdrawal was tremendous. It was so powerful that if I would take steroids for 12 weeks and then get off of them for 12 weeks, and the day I got off the steroids, I would be at the gym and I would look at myself in the mirror and I would think, oh my God, I'm already getting smaller.
Really?
Yeah, it was that strong of an effect, and that's just not the case. You're not getting smaller one day later. But it was that kind of a mind game, and it kind of really was a psychological effect.
Mm-hmm. So interesting. So what do you think today, you know, we're hearing so much about steroid use in professional baseball. Do you think that steroid use is on the rise? And what do you think about the use with professional athletes?
Steroid use in the NFL, where I played, is still there, although it's not nearly as much as it was there in the 70s or 80s. The NFL, I think, had a vision early on, you know, decades ago that said this is a problem, and if we don't really cut it off, it's going to be a really big problem in the future. So, but that doesn't mean there's still not guys doing it. There's guys doing it, and somehow they're getting away with it, or they're using growth hormone, which you cannot test for it. And growth hormone is not a steroid, but it's obviously a hormone that helps you heal faster and recover better. So there is, you know, huge performance advantages to it.
Mm-hmm.
In Major League Baseball, they kind of really shrugged their shoulders years ago and said, well, you know, we're baseball, and I don't think that we have a problem. And you know, it wasn't, although baseball is a physical game with hitting the ball and stuff like that, it wasn't like people were hitting each other like in football where you know, your strength was crucial and vital to every play. But once these guys started hitting all these home runs in the late 90s and earlier on in this decade, I think that it raised some eyebrows, and there were some inquiries, and I think Major League Baseball still shrugged their shoulders. And now, here we are in 2009, and they're in a mess.
Yeah.
They have a big problem, and they have a, not just a problem with steroids, but they have a image problem now, because a lot of people don't want to take their kids to go see these games where people are on steroids. It's kind of almost like they're thinking it's a bad example. And I can, you know, totally see their point of views. You know, they have a lot of cleaning up to do, and there's been a lot of exposure with A-Rod and some of these other players recently, but they have some cleaning up to do of that league with steroids, and they also have some, you know, trust and image rebuilding to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so tell us now then a little bit about the alcohol and drugs and how the steroid use basically transitioned into your alcohol and drug use, and really what the rock bottom was for you with that.
Well, in that transition period from college to pro football, when I, you know, quit the steroids and started taking the painkillers in a more daily fashion, a friend of mine from California, where I was living, had offered me an injectable painkiller, and he said, if this is very powerful, you should try it. It works really well. And I tried it, except he had suggested that I shoot it right at my vein in my arm. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, kind of being like what I would stereotype as a heroin addict. And I tried it, and, you know, you were euphoric within, you know, 10 seconds, and it was an incredible high. And, you know, within a week of that first shot, I was taking 5 or 6 or 7 shots a day for the next 3 years.
Oh, wow.
And it had really hooked me. That drug in that situation was the first step of a huge step downward. And then, you know, I coupled that with drinking, and the painkillers were more almost always on a daily basis. The alcohol was periodic through the week. It wasn't daily drinking until I got to the last year. Before I got sober. And then, you know, to describe the last 3 months before I got sober, I would wake up and, you know, I would take 10 painkillers and drink 5 or 6 beers before noon. And then the rest of the day, I would continue to take painkillers, sometimes up to 60 or 70, depending on what my supply was, and drink along with it to try to stay high and maintain that buzz.
It's amazing you didn't die.
I'm amazed at how resilient the body is.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Whether you've already written your manuscript or are contemplating writing one, you will need to create a book proposal. ReaderViews has a coaching service to help you create an enticing book proposal for your work of fiction or nonfiction. In fact, ReaderViews will even submit your book proposal to publishers and agents they have created a relationship with, and then they promise to pursue these submissions. Go to ReaderViews.com today and click on Services for Authors to find out more information on book proposals and how ReaderViews can help you. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with Tony Mandarich. He is the author of My Dirty Little Secret, Steroids, Alcohol, and God, which is out now on Modern History Press. You can find out more about Tony through his website, tonymandarich.com.
Knock on wood, today I'm in, for the most part, very good health. In the last almost 14 years of sobriety now, I try to take care of myself as much as possible physically by working out and trying to eat as well as I can, although that's probably my biggest obstacle. You know, you try to give yourself the best opportunity, especially knowing how much stress I put my body through for all those years of drinking and drugging.
So what really, Tony, was going through your mind when you were trying to balance your career and this daily your addictions on a daily basis, with the addictions obviously winning.
It was a full-time job to be an alcoholic or a drug addict, because I had to be ready to play professional football, and really during the season, it's a 12, 13-hour a day job. You have meetings, you have working out, you have film to watch after practice, film to watch before practice. There's just so much to it. There's so much to it that people don't see also. And then I have to hide my painkillers so nobody knows that I'm taking all these painkillers. For somebody to take one or two painkillers once a day or something is not a big deal, but to see somebody constantly take them, so I was very secretive about that. And that became, you know, hiding it all became a full-time job. And then knowing that you were a professional athlete, hiding it from your coaches, hiding it from the media, you think to yourself, well, if somebody finds out, you know, this will hit the press and then it'll be exposed. It was impossible to do, and the result that came from it was obvious. I mean, it was my career in Green Bay was an absolute disaster. Most people thought before this book came out that it was because of the steroids, and, you know, little did they know that it really was a direct result of the painkillers and the alcoholism.
You know, I'm sure that many people would wonder how, at that point in your life, where after so many years, you really had attained your dream, your life's goal, how you could sabotage it.
I can tell you, Juanita, it wasn't by choice. That will not make sense to a lot of people unless they've had a problem with addiction. Why would I want to sabotage myself? Why would I want to sabotage something that, you know, I worked really just about my whole life to get to since I was 11? And what happens is that is what alcoholism is. You're powerless over not drinking and saying to yourself, okay, I'm not going to drink today, or I'm not going to do these painkillers. And your conviction is so strong in the morning. And come 1 o'clock in the afternoon, you're kind of like, well, I feel pretty good. You know, I'm not bad. And then, still, you know, I'm still not going to do it. Well, come 6 or 7 o'clock at night, you're like, you know what? I'm just going to do it because a little bit's not going to hurt me. And then, you know, by 10, 11 o'clock, you're in the bag.
Yeah.
So it's kind of exactly what alcoholism is. It's being powerless over that addiction. So you don't have a choice at that point. Or at least I didn't have a choice that I thought I had. And it was kind of like I wanted to quit, but I couldn't quit, because if I quit, I knew I would go through physical withdrawal and be physically hurting and be in worse shape. And it was just, it was a crazy, vicious circle.
I bet there was a lot of shame, inner shame, that maybe you were conscious or unconscious of at that time, too.
Yeah, there was, and a lot of guilt, a lot of shame, a lot of embarrassment, a lot of self-loathing. I absolutely hated myself, because deep down inside, I knew that this was not the kind of person that I really was. But trying to figure out why it is this way and what's going on, and you try to analyze it, and but in the meantime, you're stuck in it. So it was the worst hell I've ever gone through in my life.
Well, how did you actually get into recovery?
You know, the last few years of my drinking, I had had a few friends talk to me about, that were pretty close friends, talk to me about maybe that I have a problem with it. But I think that, you know, I knew I had a problem, but I was still in denial that it was as serious as it was, even though I had all the evidence of my career behind me that was a disaster.
This is denial, though.
Yeah, it's the denial, and it's like, oh, well, yeah, it wasn't great, but it wasn't that bad. To really be honest with you, I just got sick and tired of myself. And I was sick and tired of me making excuses, and I was sick and tired of constantly pointing the finger at other people. And I was really tired of drinking. I was tired of doing drugs. It was, like I had said earlier, it was a full-time job trying to keep myself high. And then you get to the point where you think to yourself, well, I'm doing this for enjoyment, but it's work, and it's causing me pain and misery, so this is not enjoyment. So
that could be exhausting.
It was.
Yeah.
It was. And to, you know, to sum it up in a sentence, I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And my friend had talked to me at the end there, he didn't talk me into going into treatment. He just talked to me, and I had made the decision. He said, you know, I'll make the call and set up your inpatient stuff, and he did, and you know, I'll forever be grateful to him for that. It was just one of those things that, you know, it was a 17-day treatment session for me, and I got educated on, you know, what the chemicals and what alcohol does to your system. And, you know, most importantly for me, I got introduced to the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's been fantastic ever since.
Yeah, I understand that you're still in AA and you're very involved with the program.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. I still go to meetings and still, you know, try to help other alcoholics and other, you know, drug addicts or people that have had the same problems that I've had, and you know, to kind of say, look, I've been where you're at, and I know it's hard, but you can get out of it. And that helps keep me sober, because it's a reminder to me that it's not getting any better out there.
And, well, that's part of the whole aspect of being of service, which is part of the program as well.
Exactly, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So when you got into recovery, how did you change? What decisions did you have to make in your life at that time to really turn things around?
You know, I left treatment after 17 days, and I remember my counselor saying, there's only one thing you have to change, and that's everything.
Yep.
And
that's a scary thought.
It is. And she said, you know, you have to change your play pals and who the people you hang out with. If they're the people that you drank and drugged with and went to bars with or smoked drugs with or whatever the case was, you have to separate yourself from those people, not because you're better than, or it's just because if you continue to hang out with those people, you're going to go back to drinking and doing those things. It's, you know, the old birds of a feather flock together. And it's a true statement, and I literally changed everything. Mm-hmm. Instead of in the morning waking up and reaching for the bottle of pills and then going to the kitchen for alcohol, I would get out of bed and I'd hit my knees and I'd open my hands up and I'd ask for help from the God of my understanding. And I would read a couple meditation books, you know, before I left the bedroom to try to start my day off right. And then I started working out again and just kind of started to try to become a productive member of society again, and kind of like, well, you've been sucking so much out of life the last 5 or 10 years. Now it's time to start putting some stuff back into it and participating again. So I think I went to a meeting every day the first 5 years I was sober, but that first year especially, sometimes I would go to 2 meetings a day because I started feeling better. And when I went to the meetings, I felt better, and I could see that other people were laughing and that this thing really worked, and, you know, it became contagious in a good way.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking to the spiritual nature of the AA program, did you find it hard to go through the surrender process where you're surrendering to something greater than yourself?
For me, it was easy, and I'll tell you why. Because it was easy because I had fought it so much. I had tried to do it my way for so many years, and I had tried to find my solution, and, you know, let's do it Tony's way. And, you know, my way works. I always have the right answers. And when I looked back and I was like, you know what, all those great ideas that I had and great answers that I had and great decisions that I made brought me to my knees.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very humbling realization of, you don't know, you really don't know anything. You especially, you don't even know how to live because you can't stop taking drugs. Looking at it that way made me realize that I have no control of this thing, and I know that there's a power greater than myself. And for many years, I, you know, acted as my own God and making my own decisions for the betterment of myself, and it almost killed me.
Mm-hmm.
So
clearly,
surrendering became, in that respect, looking at it that way, surrendering became extremely easy.
Easy. You were very ready.
Yes, yes. There was no doubt that my time had come to, you know, jump off and start going the other direction.
Mm-hmm. So today, do you ever get the urge to drink or self-medicate?
I don't. I had the compulsion come back to me at about 2.5 or 3 years of sobriety, and it was with me extremely briefly for, you know, 15, 20 seconds, and it was very scary because it came out of nowhere. But I think, you know, I also think a lot of that was, even though I was 2 or 3 years sober, or between 2 and 3 years sober at the time, I still think that, you know, your mind and body are trying to repair itself from mm-hmm. all the wreckage.
Mm-hmm.
It was a compulsion to me, it was. Now, whether that was would be called clinically an anxiety attack or whatever it was, I don't care what you call it, the compulsion was there to drink. I was not at a bar. I was nowhere near a bar, not even thinking about anything like that. And, you know, what I did was I did what the people in the 12-step program said. You know, if this happens, you know, say a prayer and ask for the compulsion to be removed. And I did. And as soon as I asked, immediately the compulsion was removed and, you know, have not had it come back since. And hopefully it never will.
Wow. So did you at any time have a hard time or any problems with any of the steps?
Yeah, I did. I mean, you know, the eighth and ninth step talks about making a list of people that you need to make amends mm-hmm. to, and then the ninth step is the actual action step of doing it. And, you know, that became difficult. Even though I was living in a totally different world, a totally different mindset, spiritually different, much more open-minded, you know, had surrendered to a higher power, It was still difficult to say I was wrong. To look your father in the eye and say I was wrong was not an easy thing to do.
But so necessary.
It is. It's necessary, and it was part of my recovery, and it's part of my survival. I look at it as if I don't do this, then I'm not changing, and I'm remaining the same person that I was, who basically underlying has all the answers. And acknowledging that and doing that was extremely difficult, but extremely, you know, rewarding. And in my case, just about all the amends I've made to people over the years have been positive reaction from them. There have been some that haven't been positive, where they've said, you know what, I don't care about your apology and I don't care about whatever, just stay out of my life. And they have every right to. I cleaned up my side of the street, and I was willing to go back and say I was wrong, and they totally have the choice to not accept that. And you know, again, the old Tony wouldn't have done that, and the old Tony would have been drinking and drugging and telling you all the answers to all the world's problems, and this was a whole different way of approaching things.
So what do you think, through your journey and your recovery process, what's been your biggest life lesson?
I would say the older I get, the more right my parents were. Are. Just about everything that they told me has come true. But, you know, I was too young and a know-it-all and was like, you know, you're too old, you're from a different generation, you don't understand kind of attitude.
Mm-hmm.
That was the attitude I have. But now, you know, I'm 42 and in midlife and kind of like, you know what, I remember a lot of the things my parents said, and they were right. They were right about this. They were right about that. And I find that very interesting. So it's taught me to become much more open-minded to listen to other people's ideas and realize that I could have good ideas, but I don't have all the answers, because the way I look at the world and the eyes that I look at the world through are way different than the person standing beside me. And it's good to listen to other people. And I, before, it was my way or no way. And I can honestly tell you that there are days where I get in that mode of, we're doing it my way, and there's just no talking about it. But those days are few and far between compared to how they used to be.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you
know. You know, by no means am I perfect. I have a lot of work to do
right.
on myself, but
right.
but things are definitely better.
You're right, right. Well, you have a big family, so I'm sure they kind of keep you in check too.
Right, right, right.
That's funny. So, do you miss football at all today, or the rush of the limelight and the whole excitement of it?
Thing I miss the most, I mean, I absolutely love game day. Was absolutely awesome, and playing in front of a lot of people and playing with your buddies, and whether you want to call it going to war on the field with them, that was awesome. And the camaraderie in the locker room and in the weight room, and then being kind of like blood, sweat, and tears on the football field with these guys, you get to make some really good friends and some special relationships. And since I left the game, I have not had the opportunity or have not experienced that kind of closeness with my work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have our own company and we have less than 10 employees, and I try to make it an atmosphere where that is as close as it can be to something like that. But it's difficult because working in an office is a lot different than being in a locker room.
Yeah.
So there's things you have to be careful of what you say. There's different rules. It's all guys in the locker room here. It's men and women. So there are some parameters that you have to be very careful of, but you can still, in my opinion, get that camaraderie, but it's just getting the right chemistry of people together. And I think when you can do that, I think you end up bettering your chances of success, whether it's in business, whether it's in some kind of a group event or anything. It just makes things better when you have that kind of energy around.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, what are your future plans?
You know, as you described earlier, we have an internet marketing company that consists of search engine optimization and internet marketing, along with we do photography and video production. My biggest passion right now, or has been for the last 6 or 7 years, has been photography. So we've made it part of our business, and we have our whole separate photography business for commercial advertising and stuff like that. But now we've integrated it with internet marketing for web stuff. We're growing in a horrible economy, which I'm grateful for, but I think we're growing for a reason, too, because we're working smart. We're trying to make good decisions and surround ourselves with the right people and take suggestions and get consultation and just to keep growing. The other big, huge thing that's going on in my life is the book. And obviously, I've always said, if this book ends up being a flop and nobody cares about it, nobody's interested, if it helps one person get sober and spend the rest of their life, you know, chemical free, it was worth writing. And because I know how tough it was for me to live that way of addiction and alcoholism, and it is not fun. For me, it was a living hell, and I'm glad that it's not that way anymore. So, you know, so spinning off of the book, we'll be doing, you know, probably a book tour and speaking engagements with all things related from high school level athletics to treatment centers to corporations or, you know, special groups, things like that all over the country.
That's fantastic. Well, you certainly have a strong message that is needed today. So I see you being incredibly successful with this book and with your speaking, for sure.
Well, thank you.
Yes, absolutely. Well, let's mention your website once again, tonymandrich.com. And your book can be purchased through your site, or is that just your business site?
No, you can. Tonymandrich.com is specifically dedicated to the book.
Okay.
And, yeah, you can pre-order, or you can order it right now, and it will ship within 24 hours, and it'll ship autographed. Although Amazon and Barnes & Noble, they're selling the book now, but it won't ship until March 23rd.
Okay.
We've had an unbelievable response, way beyond my expectations, for the book not being released yet, to the public. Although it's for sale, it's not shipping unless you order it from us. But the response has been, for me, overwhelming, and I'm grateful, and I just hope that this helps people, you know, get through their adversities.
Absolutely. Well, it will. And I want to just thank you personally for coming on to the program today. This has been wonderful talking with you. I know that our listeners really will get a lot from this interview, and I'm sure that you have touched some people in a very special way today as well. So I just want to thank you.
Well, and I just want to, you know, thanks for having me on and taking the time to do this. I think, you know, as you said, I think the message is extremely important. And again, if it helps one person find a way out of their addictions, it was well worth it.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Tony. All the best to you, and I hope we get a chance to talk again in the future.
Great. Thank you, Juanita.
You bet. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, listeners, that's been Tony Mandrich. His new book, My Dirty Little Secret, Steroids, Alcohol, and God, is available now. It's out on Modern History Press, and as mentioned, you can go to Tony's website, tonymandrich.com, or amazon.com is also taking pre-orders for it. So please do check it out. It's a wonderful, wonderful book, and I know just from this interview, I mean, Tony has a lot to say, and so I encourage you to check into My Dirty Little Secret. So I want to thank you for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live. Again, I am Juanita Watson. And until next time.